This week on Grape Encounters Radio.
All right, hold on.
Okay.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, straight from the Grape Encounters studio, several tips on how to choose your Zinfandel, courtesy of Sarah Schneider, wine editor of Sunset Magazine.
Boy, these better be good.
And now, transmitting our signal to wine lovers of the world from our Atascadero Wine Cellar studio in the heart of the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California, we bring you Grape Encounters with David Wilson.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice.
All right, I have to tell you that this year I got the very best birthday present I have ever gotten in my entire life. It's one of those things that once you see it, you covet it and you've got to have it. Actually, it's funny because there are two consumer products that I coveted for a very long time. Now I have both of them, actually multiple versions of one. And that is, first of all, the Keurig coffee pot, which I think is the best thing that ever happened to coffee. And the second is something that you may not yet know about, and you will know today, it is the Coravin, and it is a device that has absolutely revolutionized the wine industry. It probably is the most significant innovation since the corkscrew. We are so pleased to have on today a gentleman who is a driving force behind the Coravin, but also was a driving force behind the Keurig coffee pot as well. It's Nick Lazaris.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me, and I look forward to chatting with you and being as close to your listeners today.
I got to tell you that I had wanted a Coravin for a long time, and it was one of those products that I kind of felt like, well, the verdict is still out on that one. You know, when I would have people come over, taste wines with me, I started to see people bringing the Coravin along, especially for the high-end wines. But for a long time, I believed that the device was really meant for the upper end, and I'm not so sure anymore. I think it's a device that actually pays for itself very quickly, even for the average wine drinker. But even if you're drinking mid-range priced wines, it seems like a good thing, a great thing to have in the house.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out, because fundamentally what Coravin is about is convenience, the convenience of being able to enjoy the wine that you want to drink at that moment and not have to commit to the bottle. And it's really a function of that convenience and that access, not so much how much you paid for the bottle. Although, of course, one of the wonderful benefits is if you paid $50 or $100 for a bottle, the glass is going to cost you much less than that, and you can enjoy that bottle over many different sessions.
Well, you know what? You just preempted my next question, because I wonder what the sweet spot is in terms of the price of a bottle of wine. Is it $50 or is it $30? What point do you use the Coravin, and at what point do you just not worry about it?
Yeah, I think there are sort of two kinds of comments there. One, as it relates to the strict economics and the thought of how much does the argon gas cost you when you use Coravin to access the bottle. The economics work all the way down to $10 a bottle. But the real benefit is not just economics. It really is that aspect of enjoyment. You know, you mentioned Keurig a little bit earlier, and I was very fortunate to be involved with Keurig in its market launch over a 10-year period. And fundamentally, the opportunity there was about a personal choice, that you could enjoy a cup of coffee without having to brew a pot. You could have a cup of coffee that you wanted to enjoy, and there was no waste. When I met Greg Lambrecht for the first time, who was the inventor of the Coravin system, and he gave me the demonstration of Coravin accessing, because this is we call this an access technology, accessing a bottle of wine, and pouring wine from the bottle without removing the cork, I was amazed, and he was telling me how transformational that had been for him personally. I was seeing all the parallels with Keurig. Now you could come home from work, select the wine that you really want to enjoy, not be put off because it is an expensive or a special bottle that you really don't want to commit to the whole bottle. And the other part about it is whoever you're there with can have their favorite as well. The wonderful thing about Greg's technology, Wine Access technology, is you can go back to that bottle again tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. The wine is not exposed to oxygen and therefore doesn't oxidize.
So let's talk about the nature of the cork for a second, because I guess when you put the needle in it, and it's a very small needle, it's surprising to me how much wine you can actually get out through such a small opening, but the cork just reseals itself. Is that how it works?
It's exactly how it works. Greg came from the medical device industry and knew a lot about needles, and when he was faced with his personal challenge, his wife was pregnant and didn't want to drink wine during the pregnancy, and yet he still wanted to enjoy his favorite wines. He had to figure out, how do I get the wine out of the bottle? And I mean, the key about Coravin is that you can pour wine without pulling the cork. And the magic to that is a specially designed needle. We call it an on-coring needle, stainless steel Teflon coated. And it is pushed through the cork, slides right through, and allows you to pressurize the bottle, remove the amount of wine you want. And when you pull the wine out, cork being the wonderfully elastic natural product that it is, reseals itself. There is no passageway left. And the cork is, in fact, a preservation device. Our technology is called wine access technology. The cork remains a preservation device, and we just allow people to access as much wine they want from a bottle whenever they want to.
We're talking to Nick Lazarus. He's the CEO of Coravin, formerly the CEO of Keurig, and it's amazing how similar these two products really are. It must have actually been pretty exciting to you to be exposed to the Coravin because, I mean, it really does the same thing the Keurig does, doesn't it?
It does. It allows people who have a beverage that they love to enjoy it in the way that they want when they want to. So in the world of coffee, to be able to brew one cup of great coffee, branded coffee, whenever you want it, exactly what you want with no waste, is a big advance and has transformed the way people enjoy gourmet coffees in the United States.
You know, it's amazing, Nick, because I was an employer for a long time, and I used to observe with great horror as employees would come into the kitchen area of the office. They would rinse out the coffee pot that was dirty from the night before, and that would take 10 or 15 minutes. Then they would put the coffee in the basket or whatever the device was for the standard coffee pot and wait for another 10 minutes for it to brew. And the day would go on and I would watch pot after pot thrown down the sink, and you would sit there and calculate how much time and money you were spending having an employee go through all of that. And I finally realized just how big the savings of the Keurig was. I'd been familiar with it, but I mean, from the standpoint of an employer, it was revolutionary because it was so much cheaper, not just in terms of no waste of coffee, but no waste of employee time. And I just thought it was an amazing innovation. And it's not just about the selection that it offers, but I see with the Coravin that it has so many implications that go far beyond what I think journalists were talking about when the product first came out. It seemed to me that the emphasis was on the higher end and being able to grab that bottle of wine out of your cellar and take just a sip of it. But, you know, so many times people will have guests over and just a few people want one wine and the rest of them want something else. And you open up a bottle and it sits, and regardless of what preservation system you use, we're talking about a 3 to maybe 7 day lifespan, right?
Exactly. And you're making that commitment with the model again. You know, your comment about coffee does play right into Coravin and wine, and that is sometimes people look at just the immediate out-of-pocket cost. But there is a full cost and a full benefit that needs to be thought of. And, you know, when you talk about office workers and time spent and lost productivity, it was clearly something our salespeople talked about with Keurig. On the Coravin side of the equation, it really is that benefit, and it's almost immeasurable. Gee, I would like this wine. It's this precious wine to me in terms of what I really want to enjoy. And I can enjoy it any time I want without committing to the whole bottle. And then the key point that you're making is Coravin is not just about drinking down one bottle over time. It really is this concept of variety and satisfying each person's individual needs, and in each case, not committing to the bottle. You know, how many times might you have had someone to your house and they don't know a lot about wine and you want to teach them and expose them to new wine, but gee, you really don't want open and uncork a bottle that might have cost you $50 or $100 because, you know, maybe they wouldn't appreciate it. Greg often tells the story when he first came up with the idea and was just using it himself of taking people down to his wine cellar and saying, you know, there's a Cabernet Sauvignon grape. Wouldn't it be fun? Let's taste different wines from around the world that are all Cabernet Sauvignon and understand a little bit about how terroir affects that.
Yes.
And people could explore and have fun. Initial customers have been people who are collectors who want to enjoy their wines more often, who might want to monitor their wines as they age. But fundamentally, people who love wine love to learn. I'm sure that's why I didn't listen to your show, to learn about so many different things about the world of wine. It's sort of an insatiable appetite for knowledge about wine in a wine world. Coravin is a tool that is going to help a lot of people become more educated more quickly about wine. And perhaps when they go to their favorite wine store, hopefully, when they're interested in buying a bottle of wine, instead of only listening to the recommendation of the person there at the wine store, hopefully they get a chance to taste it. It's sort of like Baskin-Robbins, that the wine stores will be using Coravin to allow their customers to taste wines and figure out what they like. And I know a lot of what you talk about is people finding the wine that they personally enjoy. And Corvin is a tool for that, not just at home, although that is a clear opportunity, when they're at a wine store and people can share with them different tastes of wine before they make a purchase of a bottle. And, of course, in restaurants, where we're seeing hundreds of restaurants bring Corvin into the restaurant and create a Corvin premium wine by the glass program and allowing the restaurant to now offer better wine by the glass.
Now, hold that thought for a second, because that's one of, I think, the greatest applications of the Corvin. We're talking to Nick Lazaris. He's the CEO of Corvin, formerly the CEO of Keurig. As I said, one of the driving forces behind two of my absolute favorite pieces of technology. And I'm not really a big technology fan, but when it comes to food and wine, I definitely am. We'll return with Nick in just a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to Grape Encounters Radio.
Coffee in the morning and wine at night. If I had
back with Grape Encounters Radio. One of the things that I think is true of wine lovers, they tend also to be coffee connoisseurs. Nick Lazaris is the CEO of Corvin. Nick, have you found that to be true, that the very same people who were first attracted to the Keurig are also attracted to the Corvin?
Oh, I definitely think there's an overlap. It's people who want the better things in life when they're eating and drinking, have favorite beverages. And really, it's personal choice. It's just for me. We've had people talk about, in the world of coffee, with coffee challenge households, I think I mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun when we first started our beta site testing with Corvin. For one interview we did of a fellow who, when we asked him, so how did Corvin affect you? And was it transformational in any way? He said, the most important thing was my wife and I didn't have to argue over what we were going to drink.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
We often hear people joke about Corvin has saved their marriage, you know, because it is a big commitment to a bottle. If your goal is to pull the cork on the bottle and enjoy that bottle over dinner now, people can still enjoy several glasses over dinner. They can match it with their favorite foods, but mostly they can have what they want.
But I'll tell you what, you've definitely saved the wine bars, because I think a lot of people don't appreciate the fact that at a wine bar, the reason that they're not pouring the premium wines by the stem is not because they don't want to, but because they can't, because there's not enough demand, and they end up throwing away lots of $100 bottles of wine, or I should say partial bottles of wine. And now it's, I mean, as the technology is catching on and people are seeing other people use it in a wide variety of applications, it's amazing how many wine bars are now using it.
Absolutely. One of the key points of differentiation between Corvin Wine Access technology and everything else that's out there is the fact that you can pour wine without removing the cork, without pulling the cork from the bottle. Every other system starts with a corkscrew, pulling the cork, and then trying to preserve that wine as long as they can by trying to pump the air out, spray argon in. Some systems cost thousands of dollars, but they're all fundamentally dealing with the clock. I don't know if you know, David, but the corkscrew was invented back in 1797, I think, in England. At the time, there was new technology in putting lead in glass to strengthen glass, which allowed glass to be a more common way of packaging wine, but they needed to seal it, and that's where corks came from. And in the beginning, they didn't put all the way in, or they wouldn't be able to get it out. People would twist the cork out, and then somebody came up with the invention of the corkscrew. So we like to think that Greg's invention at Corvin, 200 years later, the magic of actually being able to pour wine without pulling the cork.
You make a really interesting point in differentiation between the other means of preservation, and preservation being the operative word, because the Corvin is definitely not a preservation system, because there's nothing to preserve. Get the wine out in a very pristine fashion, and it's never exposed to any damaging elements. Okay, let's talk a moment about just exactly how the Corvin works. We touched on it briefly.
Corvin is placed on the bottle. The first thing that we'd recommend people do, press the trigger and spritz a little bit of argon in the system before the needle is pushed through the cork. And what that ensures is that there is no oxygen that's going to go in the bottle. So the first thing is spritz a little argon to purge the system of any oxygen. Press the needle through the cork. Very easy to push down. It's Teflon-coated stainless steel. steel. And it has a specially designed tip so that it's non-coring. It doesn't damage the cork. Once the needle is pressed through the cork, David, there are two holes on the side of the needle that will be below the cork and above the wine. Then you can pick up the bottle and with a Corvin on it and tip it as though you're going to pour it in the glass. When it's over the glass, press the trigger again, and that allows some argon to go into the bottle and pressurize it to a very low degree, but to pressurize it enough so that when you let up on the trigger, the pressure of the argon in the bottle pushes the wine out through the very same needle that the argon came in. So it pushes out the needle and through a spout and into your glass. Pull the needle back out through the cork, and as we discussed earlier, the wonderful thing about natural cork is how elastic it is. I think it's the most elastic material in nature. High pressure from the bottle pushes the cork closed. Remove the Corvin from the bottle, put it back in the stand, and you're done.
So for the world of wine collectors, this has made a huge difference, because before the Corvin came around, you had to open the bottle, and that was the end of it. The bottle had lost its value. I wonder how many people are actually using the product now for the purposes of verifying the quality of the wine that's in the bottle. And is the bottle still saleable after they've used the Corvin on it?
They should disclose it if that's the case, of course. And any buyer will see, if they look carefully at the top of the bottle, that there is a little evidence of a puncture on the capsule top. But we have seen people sell wine and talk about allowing the buyer to validate the wine if the buyer wants to bring a Corvin to taste the wine. So yes, I think that over time, we're going to see that even commercial transactions like that, sale of wine, can involve some validation. I think initially, and certainly we saw this in our beta testing with people who had wine collections, people not only used the Corvin to enjoy the wine that they wanted when they wanted it, but they also did, which you were alluding to, use it to monitor wines as they aged, to understand whether it's getting close to prime.
Yeah, exactly.
For heaven's sakes, if it's starting to get past prime, let's drink it, because the last thing you want to do is go to that bottle that you saved for years and years and years and find that it's really no good. It's past prime. And the wonderful thing about the combination of the internet and wine enthusiasts is they like to communicate and talk and read and learn, and that's a big part of increasing awareness of Corvin. And obviously, being with you today, David, is a big plus in that regard. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, I appreciate you being on the show. Next week, we're going to have Sarah Schneider, as we always do, in the studio, and I have a large selection of very old bottles of wine going back to the early 60s that were gifted to my wife and I. And Sarah and I are going to taste through those wines via the Corvin. So cross your fingers, Nick, on that one. The wine in the bottles, it looks like it's evaporated quite a bit. So I don't know. It's iffy. But
well, you're going to find out.
I'll let you know. Nick Lazaris is the CEO of Corvin. Keep your eyes open. Tell you what, you're going to see this product simple to find, and you will absolutely love it. Nick, I so appreciate you being on the show on Grape Encounters Radio.
He's back, and he's not alone. Your Grape Encounter continues with David Wilson and a little help from his friends.
Sometimes you just don't have enough time to cover a subject as well as you would like to. Last week on Sippin' with Sarah, we were talking about Zinfandel, and that conversation was started by Sarah sharing with me the fact that she has written a big article for Sunset Magazine about Zinfandel. So, Sarah, back here in the studio today, I don't even think we can do it in two segments, Sarah.
I'm not sure either, but your point is exactly how I feel every time I write a story. There's just not enough space to get it all in there.
Why don't you just talk to the editor-in-chief and say, you know what, this month it's all wine. That's it. In fact, the entire issue is going to be about Zinfandel.
I could have done that. You know, I had so much that I wanted to pack into that story. Zinfandel has had just a fascinating history through the quirks of the California's history, the nation's history with prohibition in there. It's just really interesting.
You sort of described it last week as California's signature wine. Maybe it's America's signature wine.
Could be. It's hardly grown anymore outside of California, though, although we didn't have it first.
In terms of grown, you mean in vineyards, but certainly not in terms of consumption.
Right. Oh, no. It's consumed across the country, and it actually came here from the East Coast.
And then there's the white Zinfandel, which I kind of equate to sushi in a way. Do you want to know why?
I can't imagine, but I do want to know.
Okay. Well, when you go to Japan, where sushi comes from, mm-hmm. you don't see a whole lot of sushi bars, right? And I always think that here in America, where we have sushi bars on every corner, that Japanese are secretly standing just around the corner going, crazy Americans eating raw fish. And I think it may be the same way with White Zinfandel, you know, that White Zinfandel sells really big all over the country.
Gallons and gallons of it go out in the world.
Millions of gallons.
True.
And then came along that little sucker named Moscato. Dirty little bugger from Italy.
Oh, don't get me started.
Well, people like Moscato.
Oh, there's very good Moscato.
They're drinking a ton of it.
And there's bad Moscato.
Yeah, but you know what? But the thing about Moscato is that when people drink Moscato, they have a clear conscience. Moscato, it sounds European. and they drink it, and it could be Chardonnay in the glass. You wouldn't know, right?
Well, except it tends to have those aromatics and be made slightly sweet.
Yeah. You can smell it. You can smell it wafting over from somebody's glass.
Absolutely.
A little perfumey.
Yep.
But I think people have less guilt about drinking Moscato than White Zin.
That's probably true because it's cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
Among young people especially.
Yes. Although it's flattening out. The surge is flattening out. So I hear from the
now sweet reds.
That is true.
Yeah, coming on strong. Okay, but back to Zin. And that is a red wine, which, by the way, can be pretty sweet at times.
It can be literally sweet, but even when it's bone dry, its fruit seems sweet. It's kind of jammy, like those berries have been simmered for a little while with spices in them.
I want you to explain that. Why is it that you can drink a wine where the fruit is very big in the wine and people taste it and they go, oh, this is pretty sweet, and that wine is bone dry? That's kind of a dichotomy, isn't it?
That is one of the biggest paradoxes, I think, and confusing terms. What is sweet in a wine? What's happening is that as your grapes, when they're on the vine, get sweeter and sweeter, literally, as they get riper and riper, those sugars go up. There is a lot of sugar in there, but the fruit is actually getting that lushness and ripeness to it. So when it's fermented, and if it's fermented all the way dry, the wine at the end still has that lush fruit plus that texture of alcohol, that sort of glycerin texture of alcohol, and people say this is sweet. And I call it seemingly sweet because it's not sweet.
Well,
the
terms that we use in the wine world are a little complicated anyway, because there's a tendency to say that sweet is the opposite of dry.
Right.
When to me, sour is the opposite. sour is the opposite of sweet.
Well,
and
that's true.
Wet is the opposite of dry.
Right.
Okay.
So we're all over the place. Maybe we just mean fruity when we say sweet.
Fruity, okay.
And Zinfandel tends to be fruity.
And a lot of other wines, when those sugars become alcohol, the fruit flavor kind of disappears to some degree.
If the alcohol is too sharp in there, too hot.
Why is it that a Zinfandel can be so fruity and high in alcohol at the same time?
I think that's a natural characteristic of that grape.
For the person who wants to choose a Zinfandel, can you divide it, do you think, into a couple of different distinct categories to help them out, or should we just sign off?
We're done. It's a really, really hard question, but I think there are some clues or some tips to point people to certain styles. I mean,
all right, hold on.
Okay.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, straight from the Grape Encounter Studio, several tips on how to choose your Zinfandel, courtesy of Sarah Schneider, wine editor of Sunset Magazine.
Boy, these better be good. I think you'd need to find out first what you like, if you like the big, lush alcohol style, or if you kind of like the leaner, deeper, spicier claret style, almost more like a Bordeaux. And then within that, if you like that big style, choose your Zins from really warm places. I just recently tasted through a lot of Zinfandels from Lodi. They were delicious, but very high in alcohol, although they were coming down from what they were a few years ago. They are pulling back. But still, it's a warmer place, really ripe. So if you like a leaner style, head towards parts of Sonoma. Like Dry Creek Valley has some wonderful claret styles. There's some very old vineyards there as well. Well, there are sprinkled across California, but for some reason, Dry Creek Valley has just been a sweet spot for great Zin. And then get to know your winemaker, the styles they're headed for. I can, you know, tell you some of the younger winemakers out there that are really, really pulling in, Morgan Twain Peterson, who has Bedrock Winery. He's the son of Joel Peterson, who founded Ravenswood. That's probably the biggest Zinfandel winery in the world. And his son is working with old vine Zinfandel that are just deep and spicy, and it kind, you have to kind of do a double take.
Okay, when somebody sees on a bottle old vine Zin, what should they expect?
You don't know how old that is because there's no legal
I know, but usually they'll say 100-year vines, something
they
like
might.
That.
And what that means is that the average age in that vineyard is 100 years old.
No.
Because
no, really?
Constantly replanting.
I never knew that.
You lose vines.
I never knew that. I thought the vines were 100 years old.
Not all of them. Some of them.
Oh, my gosh.
Some of those vines just give up the ghost.
I feel totally stupid now.
No.
Okay. They'll say century vines, 100-year vines, old vines, that sort of thing. And you're going to get the spicier, you know, more complex Zins out of that?
Usually you get something that makes you think a little bit more than the exuberant younger vines will give you. There's usually a little more concentration. The vine's output goes down through the years. So some of those old vines aren't producing very much, and it's concentrated fruit. So it tends to be darker, a little more complex with all sorts of other things in there, charcoal and spice, and they can be beautiful wines.
Okay, we got just 1 second. Can you talk Primitivo and Plavac Molly?
Okay, 1 second.
All right, 3 seconds.
3 seconds. We know all this now because of the DNA researchers. We know what these wines are. Turns out that Primitivo in Italy and Zinfandel here are genetically identical. They are the same grape. They actually express themselves a little differently, but people here can call their
Primitivo. An Italian accent.
It does. It does.
When it expresses itself.
It has a little spaghetti sauce smell in there.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, they've traced the origin of Zinfandel back to Croatia, to the Dalmatian coast. And person I love in this field who's retired now, Dr. Carol Meredith, sort of spearheaded finding out exactly what Zinfandel is and where it came from. Turns out they threw a few hits and misses in a lot of years of research and partnering with scientists in Croatia. They nailed it. And it is identical to Plavac Molly as well.
And let's not forget Mike Gergich.
Exactly. Mike Gergich, who came here from Croatia, and I actually just sat down with him last week for 3 hours and got his story. Sometime we have to talk about that. He got here and he saw Zinfandel growing in California, and he said, I know that grape. That grape is Plavac Molly. And he dogged it. He hooked up later after he really entered the wine industry here and became a true pioneer. And really partnered with Carol Meredith to help her along. And he was so satisfied when he got his answer in the end.
I was touring Croatia by bicycle last year. And I went there about 2 weeks after I had sat down at Mike Gergich's 90th birthday party.
Oh, yeah.
And so I had a bunch of pictures from the party. We were visiting this winery out in the middle of nowhere that we had bicycled to in Croatia. I mean, way out in the country. All of a sudden heard the winemaker mention the name Mike Gergich, Mayenko. His real name.
Yeah.
And I caught my ear instantly, and I realized, and he, you know, it was almost with this great pride that he, I didn't know what he was saying. We had a translator who was loosely translating it. But anyway, after the little speech that he gave that none of us understood, I pulled my camera out and I showed him a couple of the pictures of the birthday party with Mike. And he looked at the, you know, the little viewer on the back of the camera.
Sure.
And all of a sudden he went, Gergich, Gergich, Gergich.
How fun. That's great.
Because Mike had given them such credibility and brought so much attention to the Plavac Mali grape. And you can actually get the Gergich. He has a winery there in Croatia.
Right.
And he makes it in the Croatian style there, although I will tell you that the style that Gergich Hills Estates makes wines is purely, absolutely off the charts.
And it's delicious.
Really delicious. Really makes a great sin. But if you ever get a chance to get your hands on a bottle of that wine, go for it. And I'm sure you can get it all over the country. You just got to look for it.
It's one of the signature varieties there, I believe.
Yeah, it's really – it's a big brand for Croatia, I
right.
think. But a small winery in U.S. terms. Anyway, all right. That's all we're going to teach you about Zinfandel. You know what? There is life after white Zin.
So I found out.
And it's complex, and it's juicy, and it sometimes is high in alcohol, and it's really, really sexy, and there's lots of different styles. And once you know the style and you're able to describe it, you'll be in heaven.
And it's really good with barbecued ribs.
And you know the nice thing about it is it can be like biting into a cherry pie, or it can be like sipping the best glass of cab. It's that diverse.
It's all over the map.
Oh, man. I'm so glad we're done and we can take a break. And I'm going to crack open a bottle. I actually have a 1989 Gergich Hills Zinfandel. Would you like to crack it open during the break here?
I'm your friend forever.
Okay, let's go.
Okay.
Connecting winemakers, wine lovers, wine adventures, and all things wine from around the globe. You are listening to Grape Encounters Radio with David Wilson, broadcasting from our wine cellar studio in idyllic Atascadero, centrally located in the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California. And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
Right, it is time again for the Yoda of wine. It is Wilfred Wong, the chief storyteller from wine.com.
True.
You've been called the Yoda of wine, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
I knew it. Much better looking than Yoda, though. All the girls go for you. I've been to events with you. I know. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Really?
They don't even look at me. Anyway, Wilfred, remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about Merlots?
I do.
And you were talking about the fact that there's lots of good Merlot out there, and the fact that Sideways, the movie, had weeded out a lot of bad Merlot, and lots of good Merlot, and it's time to go with Merlot, you said, right?
I think it's time we look at the best Merlots out there, yes.
Yeah, can I take another twist on Sideways here for a second?
If you want.
Or do another twist? Is it do the twist? You do the twist, right? Just want to look at another twist on Sideways for a second, because okay. Since we were talking about Merlots, let's now talk about Pinots. Because, as everybody knows, Sideways popularized Pinot like it had never been popularized before, right?
That's very true.
Do you mind if I call you Father Wilfred?
If that makes you feel good, no problem.
Well, it does, because I want to actually make a confession right now.
As you should.
As I should? Confess my soul? Anyway, or confess my sins, rather.
You have many.
I want to be honest with you. I really am not a big Pinot fan.
Because you have not been converted to the best ones.
No, that's not true. I've had a lot of really really exceptional Pinots, but by and large, I kind of dislike about 9 out of 10 Pinots.
That's okay.
Oh, that is all right.
That's all right with me.
There's a lot of bad Pinot out there, isn't there?
There are many Pinot Noirs out there that are not really good.
Think of a number of reasons. There were, first of all, way too many people that jumped on the bandwagon. They tried to make a big profit after Sideways.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, you know what? If it's good enough for Miles, then we're going to make miles of profit on it.
True.
So that was number one. Number two, it's a very difficult grape to grow.
Very difficult
grape. Ask any winemaker. The finicky Pinot.
Agreed.
Grape, yeah.
The biggest problem with Pinot Noir after the Sideways movie was so many people started using other grapes in the Pinot Noir.
No, say it isn't so.
It's terrible.
You're saying there were substitutions in there?
It wasn't good.
A lot of people don't know that there's like a 25% cushion.
But there, no.
Will you explain that?
The law in the United States is a wine is called a varietal if it has at least 75% of that grape in that wine.
So could I have a wine that was 75% Pinot Noir and 25% turpentine, and it would still be called Pinot?
It has to be grapes.
Oh, it has to be grapes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, because some of the Pinots that I've tasted like they were 75% Pinot and 25% turpentine.
I can understand that.
Yeah. I don't like most Pinots, but I will tell you that there are some exceptions. And for instance, I love the Pinots that come from Monterey County.
Okay.
I don't know what it is about those Pinots. I just like the taste of those wines. Tastes good to me.
There's some really good Monterey County Pinot Noirs.
I love a lot of the Oregon Pinots.
And Willamette Valley, good stuff.
You're putting words in my mouth now.
Of course.
No, that's okay. Yes, Willamette Valley, yes. And, you know, some of the Pinots that come from the Santa Rita Hills.
Yeah.
Some of them.
Some.
But some I don't like.
I agree with you.
And then the rest of the Pinots, forget about it. Don't like. Although I will say this, that I had some delicious Pinot at Deloche up in Sonoma County.
Those are pretty good.
Delicious Deloche. Anyway, all right, just dropping names here. Anyway, I just remembered that because I went, wow, that's really good. So, but I would say the lion's share, 90% bad Pinot?
No.
Come on.
That's a bit high. I mean, there are many good wines made that are Pinots that are, they don't cut at the level that I'm talking about, great Pinot Noirs. No, they don't make it, but they're good wines still.
Okay, so how does somebody who is looking for a good Pinot determine that they're getting a good Pinot?
That is a tough question to ask and to answer, but I'll say that the areas, you look at specific appellations or AVAs, such as ones you mentioned, and maybe Russian River Valley, maybe Sonoma Coast. There are a number of these good areas. What I would concentrate are on the single vineyards productions.
Why is that?
Well, because the single vineyard productions are usually going to be made by more serious wineries, and they concentrate on a specific site, which means that you are tied to that site and what it gives. If you are buying an appellation, say you buy one in, say, Sonoma County, it may be really good, but it may be a mixture of many different sites, if most likely it is. And it could even have different grapes in there, too, to augment the body and the flavor of the wine and the color of the wine. Same thing as if you get a Monterey appellation by itself as opposed to a single vineyard. So I think I really am aiming my attention towards single vineyard Pinot Noirs. I think those are some of the best wines made in America.
It also means control.
More control, yes.
It means control. We need to talk about this next week.
We will.
The idea of estate grown versus grown who knows where.
We should talk about this.
Do you want to?
Yes.
We're going to make a lot of people mad.
That's okay.
No, seriously. If we have this discussion and I'm allowed to really open up my yap on this one, we're going to make a lot of people mad.
I'll let you make
them mad. I'm going to lose advertisers, all kinds of stuff.
But you want to be yourself, don't you?
No. I won't actually let anybody advertise on this show that doesn't make quality wine.
There you go.
Do you know that, by the way? That's a policy here.
As it should be.
We don't like the products. You're not advertising on Grape Encounters Radio. Not happening.
Hey.
By the way, even though wine.com is not actually, you're a contributor, you're not an advertiser.
True.
You're on the show because we love wine.com. Love, love, love wine.com. I use wine.com long before I ever knew you, long before I ever had any association with wine.com. First, there was wine.com, and I love the company.
You're a wise man.
Yes, I am a wise man.
You are a wise man.
Hence the golden cape and the crown. Anyway, that's going to do it for Grape Encounters today. Thanks very much, Wilfred. Talk estate grown then next week, huh?
Okay.
Do you have an estate?
Yeah, it's called the Wong Estate.
It's the Wong Estate.
It's where I live.
Oh, you could have so much fun with your name. The Wong Wine, the Wong Vintage. Yes, you can. Okay, let's not. All right, we'll be back next week. Same time, same channel. So in the meantime, go out and buy yourself some of the cheap stuff, some of the good stuff, mix them together, and you'll be just fine. Thanks.
Cool, thanks.